From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The oceans of the world are the source of life on Earth. Once believed to be infinitely bountiful, the sea is woven into the fabric of what it is to be human. Our mythology, our religion, our economies, and even our bodies are laced with the DNA of the sea. According to a startling new study out this week, 90% of large ocean species have disappeared in a handful of decades. Can you imagine the mighty oceans emptied? Coming up on Point, a fresh look at the perilous fate of the Great Blue Sea. We begin with the new findings published this week in the journal Nature. Ransom Myers is professor of ocean studies at Canada's Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and co-author of the study that found 90% of the big fish gone. I asked Ransom Myers if his study showed that the depletion of ocean life is worse than previously believed.
I believe it does, because there are a few cases where we have data that goes back to the beginning of commercial exploitation. Think about it as the Serengeti without the parks. If we went to Africa and saw the many areas that are eroded, goat-ridden, with bark stripped off of trees, overgrazed, and compare those to the great parks of the Serengeti and the Ngorongoro crater, you would never be able to guess that the abundant and diversity of life that exists in the Serengeti by just looking at vastly overgrazed ranch land. Similarly, in the ocean, we typically overfish to a great extent so that the larger, slower-growing fish, marine mammals, and marine turtles are reduced to a small fraction of their original abundance.
Ransom Myers, how far back did your study go? And paint a picture comparing the situation in the seas at the outset of that period and what it is now.
At the outset of the period, in the 1950s, you could go and put hooks in the water, long line. A long line is 100 kilometers, 60 miles of rope with 2,000 or 3,000 hooks, baited hooks. And when you first went to an area of the tropical or subtropical or even temperate fishing zones, you could typically catch 10 large tuna and billfish per 100 hooks, typically in the 1950s. And now if you go to the same areas using the same technology, except now you have satellites to help locate the features you want to fish in, and you have more efficient gear, you typically only catch one-tenth of that. And that's mirrored in, if you look at trawl surveys. We have data from the Antarctic islands off the Gulf of Thailand and in the southern Grand Banks where the scientific surveys took place at the beginning of commercial fishing.
So is that how you calculated the 90% decline in large fish stocks?
Yes, across the board. And because we used scientific surveys or these long-lining data that went back to the beginning of commercial fisheries. In many areas, you don't have such data. For example, on George's Bank off of Massachusetts, we have no surveys that go back to the 1850s, which is where you would have to go in that very, very long developed area. Similarly, in the North Sea, they had steam trawling intensively in the 1880s and 1890s. So for these earlier areas, you actually can't get a good empirical look of the way the oceans were because we have no scientific data for those periods.
What were the species that you looked at in the study?
We looked at all the larger species. I mean, in the Grand Banks, we looked at the cod, haddock, redfish, wolffish, flatfish, halibut, these kind of species in the middle of the Atlantic and Pacific and Indian Oceans. We looked at the large marlins, swordfish, tunas, bluefin tuna. And in the shallow waters of the Gulf of Thailand, we looked at groupers, guitarfish, and a whole variety of tropical species. In the Antarctic islands, we had data on Antarctic cod, Antarctic icefish. And if you looked at the sum of the weights of all of these species in the virgin state compared to now, they're one-tenth the number.
The oceans you describe cover such a vast area. Can't these species hide in there somewhere?
And we can now trawl down to 2,000 meters, which is around 6,000 feet. We exploit isolated seamounts. We use specialized gear to exploit the Patagonian toothfish or Chilean sea bass on the edges of the Antarctic shelves. So there's very little area where fish can now hide.
Is it possible, given current fishing technology, that these species could be fished to extinction, or is it simply the economic impact of vastly diminished stocks that has you concerned?
if we want to act as, for example, Alaska has acted, preserve the fish diversity and fish in such a way as you don't drive any part of the ecosystem to extinction, you can get vastly more fish a sustainable way and get a constant income for a large number of fishermen. However, if you choose to overexploit the system, for example, as Canada did off of Newfoundland, you have cod stocks that were so vast it supported tens of thousands of people for centuries, reduced to the point where now they're declared endangered by the Canadian government.
And what's the trend line globally at this point, Ransom? Has this bottomed out? Have we at least reached a stable level of fish, or are they still being diminished, these stocks?
It's my belief that we've reached a stable level in terms of the fish we can exploit from the ocean, because we keep taking smaller and smaller fish that eat lower and lower in the trophic levels and eat detritus. However, the great fish of the world's oceans, for example, the great sharks, are usually in great trouble. If you look around the world, wherever you look and where there's data, you find a great decline in the large threshers and the hammerhead sharks of the world. It's these big, slow-growing species that are caught as bycatch that are of most concern.
And how do you look at the implications of this if the fishing practices and volume continue economically on food stocks, on the ecology?
We simply don't have the ecological models or the ecological insight to predict the consequences. However, we know that in some cases where we've overexploited, the system flips into a state where it doesn't recover. For example, off the Newfoundland, the great cod stocks are no more and they're not recovering. Fishing was greatly reduced and they're still not recovering. The system has changed in a way that we don't understand. So I think the key thing is to reduce overexploitation. That doesn't mean to stop fishing, but it means to fish in a sustainable way. And when you do that, you end up with more fish and all the species survive.
And what about figures coming out from the U.S. government just these last few days where they say American fisheries have been experiencing, quote, steady incremental improvement? They talk about some species once in trouble now being fully rebuilt and other species, scores of them, recovering. This sounds like a positive description of what's going on.
I think there are positive indications in the U.S., for example, in terms of some of the species are certainly recovering and some are certainly increasing. But overall, I'm talking about a global picture. We aren't talking about the U.S. in this study. If you look at the coast of Africa, the Gulf of Thailand, or even in Canada, this is certainly not the case. There are local success stories, but they are preciously rare in the world.
Ransom Myers, when you finally sat down with all the numbers and crunched them through the computer and out came the final results, were you shocked, or is this pretty much what you expected, this great diminishment?
What I think was most shocking is our first analysis was on the southern Grand Banks. And there, the first species that was initially exploited by trawlers was not cod, but in fact haddock. And there was 1 million tons of haddock on the southern Grand Banks, and that stock was fished to virtual extinction, certainly commercial extinction, perhaps 1 million times reduced from what it was. From a stock that produced enormous wealth, you had something that was almost extinct. And this vast overfishing occurred because once it was reduced, you could continue to fish as bycatch. It didn't necessarily mean to catch the species, but you continue to catch it by other means. If you think that all the U.S. stocks recovered, you only have to look at halibut off the coast of Massachusetts and Maine. There was once a very large fishery for this species, but it's been reduced to the point where the catches are very, very, very low.
It's difficult at this point even to imagine or recreate in the mind's eye what the seas once held.
If you look at the old anecdotal and historical data, the descriptions of the large sharks, the large marlins, the large codfish really do not square with what you see now. That doesn't mean that if you fish, you're going to reduce the fish stocks. That's not an issue. But you shouldn't reduce them to the point where you lose whole species and reduce them to the point where they don't recover. That's what has happened in many areas of the world, for example, cod off of Newfoundland, and I believe for most of the great shark species of the world.
Ransom Myers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ransom Myers is professor of ocean studies at Canada's Dalhousie University and a co-author of this week's study in the journal Nature on the depletion of large fish stocks. He spoke with us from Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Time was, and not so long ago, that the oceans of the world were boiling with life, and human beings thrived on that bounty. Today, huge portions of that life are gone, fished away with ever more voracious fishing technology. Even our sense of what the oceans once held, what they might hold again, has been radically diminished. The implications are economic, environmental, and enormous. It is suddenly horribly possible to imagine the once teeming seas of myth and fact as an empty bowl. Can you imagine empty or nearly empty oceans? Do humans have the will, the imagination, to turn this around? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Daniel Pauly, professor of fisheries at the University of British Columbia and author of In a Perfect Ocean and Darwin's Fishes. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Pauly.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Islip, Long Island, is Carl Safina, author of Song for the Ocean Blue and Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival. Good evening and welcome, Carl Safina.
How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for joining us tonight. Daniel Pauly, take us in here. We just heard in some detail about how oceans, and I guess we knew this, but maybe didn't know that the state, but they are no longer in their virgin state. But little of the world is in its virgin state anymore. Is there something to be especially concerned about in the seas?
Well, you see, when we replace a forest by a field, it is in order to get whatever we are growing. So we get actually more out of the field than we get out of the forest, unless we lose the soil, the topsoil.
Take down the trees and put in wheat and you still have a crop.
Right?
Yep,
huh?
Yep. Take down the trees and put in wheat, you still have a crop.
You still have a crop, and that crop, if you do your thing right, you can continue this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
However, when we fish, when we overfish, we are not replacing what we are taking out with anything. So it's not that we gain from the depletion. We actually lose at many levels. One of them is that we lose the reproductive capacity of that population. And then because the density, that is the amount you catch per unit time, becomes less, you're actually wasting economic resources, fuel, time, etc., to go after those fish. That's another implication of this dilution, if you like, of the fish.
Daniel Pauly, you've written about our children or grandchildren harvesting nothing more than plankton stew from the ocean, which raises the specter of a nearly empty ocean.
Yeah.
Is that a real risk? I mean, people know there's a problem. Are fishermen still acting in such a way that we could end up with, you know, jellyfish and desert in there?
Well, it's already happened. You see, these things, it's beginning. When I was young, I was in Southeast Asia a long, long time, mm-hmm. and there were fisheries for jellyfish. And so when, in 98, when I described this phenomenon that we call fishing down marine food webs, I used jellyfish as a metaphor for something horrible, that in the West we would fish jellyfish and that's all that is left. You know, this kind of mm-hmm. jello that floats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is that in the meantime, jellyfish is being fished in the U.S. and is being exported to East Asia. So something that you use as a figure of speech for in 2-3 generations is actually happening now.
Carl Safina, the metaphor of the last buffalo comes up here. Is it appropriate for the oceans?
I started talking about the oceans as the last buffalo hunt about 15 years ago. I think it's a very, very direct parallel on many levels. And, you know, you opened up earlier by saying that this seems to suggest that the oceans are no longer in their virgin state. But there's certainly a big difference between being no longer a virgin and being a rape victim.
Yeah. But can it come down to that last catch? I mean, we nearly took buffalo right off the prairie entirely. Is there the same risk here, or is the replenishing power of the sea somehow different?
I don't think it's any different in principle. And we also, one thing to keep in mind is that we took the most abundant bird in North America, the passenger pigeon, and drove it to complete extinction. We effectively drove the buffalo to extinction. They were saved very consciously. Just the last handful of them wound up on somebody's ranch, and then they were reintroduced to a number of places. We just about lost whooping cranes, and, you know, we did a real job on land.
And there's the risk in the seas right now. Carl Safina, Daniel Pauly, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about empty oceans, depleted fish stocks, and the fate of the planet. Will we take the last tuna the way we nearly took the last buffalo? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
This is On Point. We're talking tonight about empty oceans, depleted fish stocks, and the fate of the planet. My guests tonight are Daniel Pauly, professor of fisheries at the University of British Columbia, and Carl Safina, author of Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, and Song for the Blue Ocean. You can join us as well. Did you read the story this week that said 90% of fish in the large ocean species are gone? Will we take the last tuna the way we nearly took the last buffalo? Can you imagine empty oceans? And our nation's in denial because we just don't see what's underwater, what's no longer underwater. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Carl Safina, we had to cut out for the break there, but I still think there's a difficulty of imagination about what was there, what's there now, and what may be there if we stay on a destructive track. How do you describe it to convey to people who don't spend their time with their eyes underwater?
Well, that's the problem, is that the ocean has this very opaque blanket of all this water. If we could see, we would realize that we'd have the old black and white photographs, just like we have on land, to show the huge flocks of passenger pigeons and the big herds of buffalo. We don't have those photographs in the ocean. We do have the memory of many, many people who are still alive today who can tell you how extremely different it was when they were young men and women at work on the oceans 30 or 40 years ago. Mm. And I can tell you that just in the last 20 years, the difference that I have seen is so striking that it's really quite impressive.
Quite impressive in that what's absent now that was there before.
Yeah, the things that were there before that you just never see anymore or see so few of or so fleetingly. But one flip side of that, though, is that, and this proves that it's not just that we happen to remember the good times, some of the inshore species on the east coast of the United States are recovering as a result of recent laws that have forced fisheries managers to restrict fishing and reduce fishing pressure. So, you know, well within my memory, I can tell you that the inshore species 10 years ago mm-hmm. were in general in worse shape. But the big fish, the offshore species, have never in the history of the planet been this scarce. And as I say, well within the working memories of many people who have been on the water, the sharks we used to see at the surface, the schools of tuna, the marlin that we would see, the fish that we would catch, so many of them are not there. I haven't seen in the last 5 years combined the numbers of sharks of some species that we would frequently see in one day.
Daniel Pauly, fill in that checkerboard for us. Is it a checkered situation globally? Do we have spots of deep diminishment of stocks here and others that are recovering? You describe a scene in Indonesia of men going out after chasing the very last fish. How do you paint the big picture here?
There is no big reserves. There is no place where this phenomenon has not happened. And the reason is because the boats, the fleet, they go from one place to the other. And if there were a place with lots of fish, there would be immense pressure on it to open it. There is a bird reserve in Mauritania, in West Africa, which has water adjacent. And until recently, it functioned as a marine reserve. And that's the only place along the West African coast where there are sharks left. It's going to be opened up because it's the only place left where the big boats can go, and they will be going in there.
And yet we go into the restaurants, Daniel Pauly, and there's still fish on the menu. You go to the store, and there's still fish on the ice.
Yes, and when you fall off the 19th floor of a building, when you reach the second floor, nothing has happened really yet. and the point here is that there is massive import of fish from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, to North America, Japan, and Europe. And you can map this. It's almost like a hole that you burn through a map that mm-hmm. expands. Mm-hmm. And It's similar to the depletion itself. It expands from the area around the developed countries, and it expanded toward the south and into deeper water.
So we are now
at the edge of this expansion, but then you don't notice it because of the imports.
Then project forward those final two floors for us. What do you foresee on the trend line that the planet is on in terms of fish stocks? Look out 10, 20, 50, I don't know how many years. Where are we headed?
What I foresee is that in the Gulf of Maine, instead of fishing cod and redfish, they will be fishing sea urchin and sea cucumbers. Oops, no, it's not a prediction. It's already happening. What I foresee is that in the Gulf of Mexico, there'll be no snappers. Oops, it's already happened. What I foresee is that in the Gulf of Thailand, you catch 10, 20 kilograms of fish per hour instead of 400. Oops, it's already happened. That means all the catastrophes that you could imagine would happen in the future have already happened. What I foresee is that the North Sea will be closed. Well, it has already happened last year. They closed 40% of it because there's no more fish to catch. So what I foresee is that traditional companies will go broke in Britain and in Scotland. Well, they have last year. So the catastrophe is happening under your very eyes.
Daniel Paul,
happening right now.
It's almost too much to take on. I think somehow we still want to look out at that blue sea and imagine, the painting, the schoolbook paintings of fish.
We can swim. I mean, we can swim in the water. That's no problem.
But I think we still project life out there. You describe it as gone. Daniel Pauly, Carl Safina, standby. I want to welcome into our conversation Phil Klein, joining us from Washington. He's a 26-year commercial fisherman. He's founder of the Pacific Marine Conservation Council. Good evening and welcome, Phil Klein.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Phil, you spent many years on the water fishing, and then you pulled up your lines and turned to conservation. What happened? Why?
Well, I could see about a decade ago that I primarily fished for ground fish on the West Coast, mm-hmm. What you would call a red snapper type fish, mm-hmm. And that we were depleting the fish stocks. So I got very involved in conservation as a full-time fisherman. And not being very successful a decade ago at changing the way we prosecuted our businesses, about 5 years ago, I was alarmed enough that watching the stocks that I depend on diminished to the point where I could see when the scientists did their next round of stock assessments and made an estimate of how many were out there that our fisheries managers were going to be closing down fisheries and severely limiting how many we could kill. Mm-hmm. And so I decided then that I would try to find a job where I could be an advocate for the fish because they can't talk for themselves. And I ended up working first for American Oceans Campaign, which recently merged with Oceana, and I now work for Oceana as a fish advocate. It's the only way to save our fishermen is if they have something to catch. And sure enough, what happened on the West Coast was exactly what I saw happening, and the West Coast groundfish fisheries are shut down to very, very, very low levels where very few fishermen at all could make a living. And these are very long-lived fish, and it's going to take decades and decades for them to recover.
Phil Klein, do you see the determination to wait those decades to let these areas turn around? And in that, do you see the beginning of a restoration of the ocean fisheries, or is this just a little Band-Aid on a big problem?
Well, right now it's a little Band-Aid on a big problem. The United States policy for preserving our fish stocks is probably some of the best policy in the world, but it's very hard to get it implemented because of the short-term economic consequences of having to put some people out of business. The reality is we have more boats and more fishermen and more technology to catch fish than we are ever going to need on this planet ever again. It's kind of like a good analogy would be forests. When we had virgin forests, there was a lot of loggers and a lot of mills. But as we cut all the trees, we didn't need as many loggers or as many mills.
Phil, can you imagine the ocean as an empty bowl? Are we there? Are we near that?
We are certainly going that direction if we don't take hard steps now, particularly internationally, to address these issues. And people people need to get involved. The ocean is everyone's heritage. And if you want to learn more about it, come to the Oceana website at oceana.org and find out more information about the ocean and how you can get involved in protecting it.
We've got it. And we're going to look at how this might be turned around. We have an awful lot of people who want to join this conversation. I want to turn to them. Gary's calling from Lawrence, Massachusetts. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
As a sport fisherman, for trout in the ponds here, which we stock in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and off the coast fishing for stripers from the land, I've noticed that a fella in a canoe can go into Forest Lake in Methuen here, and he's got a little device where he can see the trout under his boat, a fish finder. If he's got that, what's a 1,000-foot factory ship got? And they've been there for a number of years now. I can well believe this. And if you look historically at the records of people such as this particular pirate who used to travel around the Caribbean, he talked of you couldn't see the sand for the turtles. This, as you say, is a veneer. You can't see yourself below the ocean, but believe me, with the technology, people who are out after these fish certainly can see exactly where they are and how to get them.
Gary, how long have you been out there fishing?
Well, I'm 52, and I've been doing this since I was 5 years old with my dad. And I have noticed the ponds in New England ruined by mercury, where our bass that used to be wonderful to eat are now not so good for you anymore. And out at the sea, the stripers that people used to commonly pull in 42, 45, 48-inch fish, they're not seeing so many of them anymore.
I guess they're not. Gary, thank you for your call. Carl Safina, I want to put this to you. I mean, Gary speaks to that kind of love of fishing and what he sees happening, but this is so deep in human culture. Do you think humans are capable of pulling back from the oceans, or is the instinct to go out and put those hooks in just too powerful for us to resist, even if the stocks are going to zero?
Oh, I don't really think that we are so driven by instinct that we can't figure out better ways to do things. And we have, as I mentioned, in a few places implemented some laws and regulations that have brought mm-hmm. fish onto the mend and onto a recovery trajectory. He was mentioning striped bass, and
right.
although it's true that there were in the past more really big individual striped bass than there are right now, they went through about a 20-year cycle of very, very deep depletion striped bass of all sizes were extremely scarce, and now the young and the intermediate numbers have been very much recovered for over a decade, and that was strictly a result of changing some laws to allow the females to get big enough to lay eggs a couple of times before they could be caught, and putting some fishing quotas in place. The counterintuitive effect of that is that there are a lot more people catching them now. They're making a lot more money. The marinas are all full of boats and happy fishermen as a result of this restraint, which is, I think, all very positive and very hopeful. And we need to take that way of doing things and use it as a template and apply it to different fisheries. All you need to do is what you were told to do the first time anybody ever took you fishing as a child. They said, we're going to throw the little ones back and save them for tomorrow, and we'll leave a few for next time.
And yet, if that's all we need to do, we know how terribly difficult that seems to be to accomplish globally. John's calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
You used the analogy of the buffalo only being preserved because the last few of them happen to be on somebody's ranch.
Yep.
And that doesn't work in the middle of the deep ocean. It's not owned by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It takes international cooperation to make this work. And this is something that the world doesn't always do all that well. Have there been any success stories? Are there any international organizations that seem to have more effectiveness than others?
Good question, John. Thanks for calling it in. Daniel Pauly, what about it? You've got national territory. You've got international territory. Is that part of the reason it's been hard to pull this together?
I'd like two remarks.
Please.
One of them is that international cooperation has worked for marine mammals. I mean, the marine mammal fisheries, if you like, have been curtailed. And 100 years ago, even sea fur seals were overexploited and mm-hmm. they were brought back from the brink by international cooperation.
So why not the rest?
So And the other thing that should make us a bit optimistic is that, in fact, most of the depletions, most of the fish, most of the fisheries are within the exclusive economic zone of various countries.
Because they're near the shore.
Right. And so we could, in principle, the individual countries could give an example, especially the richer country, in rebuilding their stocks. If they do that, then they can acquire this way the moral authority to kind of say, now let's do the same thing in the international waters. But basically what is happening right now is that the countries, Canada is a good case in point, have ruined their fisheries inshore and then blamed the Spaniards for fishing at the edge of the exclusive economic zone, as if they were the one that had dragged everything down. So there is this, everybody is kind of trying to find the lowest common denominator, passing the buck, while in fact, most of the work that needs to be done in the within the exclusive economic zone of the various countries.
And Phil Klein, look out to sea for us. We know there are great globe-circling fleets out there that are armed with super technology, and they are voracious. Do you see laws in place or coming that might put some clamps on that?
Well, in the international waters, it's still a huge problem to get international cooperation. But these fish are migratory, and they have nursery areas and breeding areas. And as we learn more about them, we can protect certain areas. Off the east coast of the United States and the Gulf of Mexico, we have areas that are critically important for juvenile swordfish to live in. And we've been able to close those areas to fishing to protect juvenile swordfish. And we're seeing some recovery in that. So like Dr. Pauly said, if we can set good examples where we have the ability, i.e. in our own waters, and we can use our political system to get those kinds of policies, hopefully that will be an example that we can export to the global scale.
But does that mean we'll be locking up fish stocks for 5 years, 10, 50? What are we talking about here?
It depends on the life histories of the fish. Fish that grow fast and breed young, like cod in New England, we could probably have those totally rebuilt, a scientist estimate, in less than a decade if we slow down our killing of them right now. Other fish like the rockfish off the Pacific coast that live to be well over 100 years old and have very few babies, no, it will take decades and decades for fish like that to recover. So it's hard to generalize, but you can generalize that if you protect the spawners and lower your exploitation rates to where you're going to continue to rebuild the stocks, it is possible to rebuild probably all the fish stocks.
Phil Klein, we hope you live so long to fish richly again. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Phil Klein, a 26-year commercial fisherman, founder of the Pacific Marine Conservation Council, and now program manager at Oceana, an international organization devoted to protecting the ocean's health. We're talking tonight about empty oceans, depleted fish stocks, and the fate of the planet. Would you give up fish for 5 years, 15, if it would help restock the oceans? And what's at stake in nearly empty seas? Do humans have the imagination, the will, to turn this around? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about empty oceans, or the vision of empty oceans, depleted fish stocks, and the fate of the planet. My guests tonight are Daniel Pauly, professor of fisheries at the University of British Columbia and author of In a Perfect Ocean, and Carl Safina, joining us from Islip, Long Island, author of Song for the Blue Ocean. You can join us as well. Will we take the last tuna the way we nearly took the last buffalo? Can you imagine empty oceans? And what's the solution here? How do we repopulate the seas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Leo's calling from Salisbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Leo. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it's a remarkably complex situation because what we're asking the fishermen to do is give up a way of life where they're living by their wits, and it's compounded by the technology. I mean, 20 years ago, you had Loran A, and there's no side-seeking sonar, and just the technology that's available now, you can find the fish. Not only that, everybody else can find the fish. And you're dealing with a group of people who who want to go to work and live by their wits, and it's a hunter-gatherer thing, and in fact, that time has gone by. And how do we incorporate that kind of thinking and that kind of living?
Leo, do you fish yourself
society?
Commercially?
What?
Do you fish yourself commercially?
I did. You can't do it anymore. I ran a little dragger and I ran a little scalloper. And, I mean, I could give you lots of little anecdotal things that more or less prove the point. One of the most wonderful guys I ever knew fished with a, I have books, registers and books where guys were using line of sight. You get this buoy at that and you mm-hmm. get this light at that direction, and you tow for so long, and you could barely read the bottom with the sounders they have now. Now you can pick up different colors with different bladders.
So
you know what kind of fish you're going to catch, yeah.
Right?
And
so,
this is what these guys want to use, and they're doing themselves in.
You can take it right to the bottom of the bowl, and yet as you say, Leo, it's a living. Carl Safina, how do you respond? Because of course, all over the world, there are people who make their daily living from the seas, and yet that's right up against the seas themselves at a certain point.
Well, we either have to throttle back in time to get it back, or we just let them keep going until we have none left. It's not a choice. It's just a matter of the only choice is whether we're going to have some fishermen in the future or no fishermen for a long time. That's really the choice. We can't have all the people who depleted much vaster populations of fish keep going at that rate. It's a physical impossibility.
And Daniel Pauly, paint the solution more clearly for us. How much of the Earth's oceans do you think, I know you think they need to be put kind of off limits for fishing. How much need to be locked up, turned into no-take zones, and for how long?
Well, I'm not going to give you a number because...
Give us a sense.
A sense would be perhaps half.
Wow.
Perhaps half of it. But again, most of the fishing we do is actually... Really, in a business sense, it's actually bankrupt. It's actually not profitable. Leo, the gentleman who just mm-hmm. called,
yes.
actually was saying it.
Yes, he
now,
did.
Now, why do these companies continue? They continue because we subsidize them. Our tax money is actually used at the tunes of billions of dollars every year to actually compensate the fishers or to enable them to operate. It ranges in various countries from... subsidies on buying the boat, on building the boats, on operating the boat, on sending them satellite information to find out where the fish should be caught, on guaranteeing the price, mm-hmm. on giving unemployment money. These are incredible sums.
So kind of a subsidization of lapping up the last few pounds of fish.
Right. It's crazy if you think about it. Now, here is a solution. If we use the money that we are presently using to keep this bankrupt operation going, to actually ease the departure of fishers from fishing, to actually ease it. In other words, instead of giving money to people which they will use actually to buy new boats
mm-hmm.
as subsidies, how about giving them, stocking up the retirement fund? Lots of older fishermen actually continues because the retirement fund.
So just say, take the money and please get out of fishing at least for
yes.
a while.
Yes. Very often the young men, they don't want to go fishing. And the young woman don't want to go in the first place.
But it's what they know, and they're often subsidized to do it. We've got it. Tim's
That's
calling
right.
from San Francisco.
So,
hi, Tim. You're on the air. Hello, Tim.
Hi,
are you there?
Yeah.
Hi.
I have a question about destructive fishing practices.
Yes.
As I understand that there are certain practices like long lining, for example, where they use lines that are 40, 50 miles long with thousands of hooks in the Pacific. They set millions and millions of hooks every day.
Mm-hmm.
There's destructive bottom trawling where they drag these huge nets along the bottom over coral and sponge habitat and rocky bottoms that are habitat for many different kinds of fish. Why can't something be done about these most destructive forms of fishing to encourage people to fish sustainably? And we know that these kinds of practices are going on, where there's a tremendous bycatch of other kind of species, the non-target species.
So, Tim, you're saying outlaw certain technologies, perhaps?
Pardon?
Outlaw certain fishing technologies that are particularly destructive.
Absolutely. And why can't that be done under the current U.S. law, the Magnuson Act? And one of the major reasons it can't be done is because they've put the fox in charge of the hen house.
That meaning?
meaning that the fishermen are the ones that are regulating themselves.
But it's a great question, Tim. Thanks for calling in. And Carl Safina, how about it? Is there a way to make longline fishing technology and the rest of it like as illegal as a sawed-off shotgun?
Well, some of those technologies have been banned in some areas, and I think that in the future we will need to go toward more of a zoning-type approach to the oceans. Right now it's a big free-for-all. On land, you can't just put a high-rise hotel in the middle of a suburban housing development in most cities, and we've decided what activities are appropriate in what places, and I think that we're going to have to start approaching our use of the oceans that way. At one time, we had vast areas of no-take marine reserves, and they were called too far and too deep. And we don't have those places anymore because people can go anywhere across the ocean or from the surface to the bottom. They have all the electronics you've been hearing people commenting on.
Right.
So we need to, in a sense, resurrect the situation that had occurred when people did not have all these tools by a system of regulations and delineations to say this gear is allowed here, but it's not allowed there.
Let's zone it like we'd zone a town.
Yes.
Well, Brian's calling from Yarmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I just want to comment on the fact that I think that this issue sort of transcends a major problem in society today of when is enough enough. I mean, we saw it with Enron, WorldCom, and everything else there. And why can't we regulate this more? Why isn't there an industry or in place or the buyers and the sellers saying, you know, I'm not going to stay out till my cargo is full of fish and then go in and sell it. I'm going to stay out for 2 days and catch what I catch. Or why aren't the people that are buying it say, you know, we're only going to buy so much fish from you?
Yeah.
And why isn't there more control in the buying and selling of the fish?
It goes to this question of will and organizing things. Brian, thanks for the call. Daniel Pauly, you write, I guess, right along these lines, that these no-take zones and really effective responses to the depletion of the seas will only come into effect when you say the true owner of the ocean resources, the public, demands it, and you say that has yet to happen. Why hasn't that happened? Is the sea just too incomprehensible?
Actually, it is because somebody was mentioning that and saying that very well. It is the fox in charge of the chicken house. In the management in the U.S. is fisheries management is largely run by councils, of which there are seven or eight. Now the councils are run by industry representatives. It's the fishing industry running itself, and in fact, it's the only sector of the U.S. economy where the conflict of interest legislation does not apply.
But how do you, okay, granted that, the solution would seem to be the same one you proposed. Get the public really focused on it
that's
in a way
exactly
that they oversee the fox.
That's why we're talking. And that's why basically what we must get to is that the public, as a true owner of this resource, says, I don't want this tenant in my house that messes up everything. I want another tenant or a better behaved tenant who doesn't trash everything, that all the furniture.
But instead, what the public often reads in the newspapers is an argument about whether or not certain areas need to be closed off, and there's always someone saying, no, they don't. There are fish down there.
Yeah. Well, yes, but then you have to look at who is it who says that.
Oh, it's hard to follow all the bouncing balls here. Scott's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm very interested on maybe another solution, and that is fish farming. How is that coming about? I know there's a lot of salmon fish farming, like
sure.
In Scotland and England.
Right.
Can I answer this one?
Yes, please.
Because to me, if you can cut down on demand, or you know, come up with alternative resources or places where you can get the fish, that would help.
So let's domesticate. Let's domesticate a little bit. Thanks, Scott.
A simple answer to this: there are two forms of fish farming. One is where you feed the fish with the equivalent of grass. That is carp and tilapia and oysters and so on. They feed on phytoplankton and so on. They will be a net addition. You really supply the market with new fish, if you like.
No, I'm sorry, Daniel Pauly, I want to understand exactly what you mean. There's fish farming where the fish are fed what?
Well, plankton.
Which makes them a net addition to the seas?
To a net addition to our supplies of fish.
To the food supply, all right.
Right. There is the other form of aquaculture, where I call it the bee aquaculture. That's the one where we feed fish to fish.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we take sardines or herring or anchovies, grind them up, and feed them to salmon.
And is now, this a net addition? I guess not.
It's not. Now, when you look at the fish statistics, at the statistics of about fish, people will say, oh, we catch that many sardine, that much sardine, and then that much salmon.
But the salmon are eating those sardines, some of them.
You cannot add them up.
Right.
Because you lose them.
Then what about, let me ask you this, what about this notion of sustainable stocks? We hear this phrase. Is there such a thing as a sustainable stock?
In principle, there is, but we have never been fishing sustainably because what we did is that the technology enables us to grind up on stock and then move on to the next, deeper, further offshore.
Mm.
And really, we were... What looked like sustainable before, fisheries that lasted a long time, is simply fisheries where we didn't know how to get to that fish that was further offshore.
And once we did, we grabbed it. I want to get one
once
more call.
Once we know how to do it,
yeah,
we go. And
we do it.
Sustainability has to be invented.
Mike is calling from Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a question about what I, as a consumer that loves seafood, my wife and I love seafood, but
don't we all
about this issue? What can we do to help out?
Yeah.
Is this where we should reduce the demand on the system at large by
vote for somebody who will create a marine protected area.
Well, but start, Daniel Pauly, and thanks, Mike, for that, because I'm sure that's on many people's minds. Start at the supermarket, at the grocery, at the fish counter. Is it wrong to be eating fish from the open sea?
Well, I can tell you that there are a number of organizations that are putting out information to direct consumers away from things that are depleted and very badly managed.
And are they right to do that? Is this good guidance or is this overkill? What do you call it, Carl Safina?
Well, it's a big part of my program, so I think it's a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually seen my organization is called the Blue Ocean Institute, and we've actually seen a tremendous amount of interest because a lot of people want to know how they can continue to enjoy seafood without continuing to harm the ocean.
So, give us some quick consumer guidance there on do's and don'ts.
Well, as I say, there are lists of information that are out there, and there's a book that we put out called The Seafood Lover's Almanac. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has information on its website. The Blue Ocean Institute will be having some updated information on its website. The group Environmental Defense has information about farmed fish on their website, and these sites are updated frequently. There are various kinds of products that you can carry around with you in your wallet and in your purse.
So there's a steady flow of guidance. And Daniel Pauly, we're almost out of time here, but your top advice to listeners tonight on the consumption side, on the legislation side, in a nutshell.
Yeah, we are not only consumers, we're also citizens. We should vote for people who say, I'm going to do something about that.
And doing something means creating no-take zones in your mind.
Yes, among other things.
Daniel Pauly, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Daniel Pauly is professor of fisheries at the University of British Columbia and author of In a Perfect Ocean, Fisheries and Ecosystem in the North Atlantic. And Carl Safina, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Carl Safina is with the Blue Ocean Institute. He's author of Song for the Blue Ocean and Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Roths, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris O'Connor and Sabi Mir. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.